is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hey, Hoopheads. Wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and they truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Also, make sure to check out the new Dr. Dish Home Machine, which is perfect for these crazy times when gyms and schools are closed. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Pat Baldwin, head men's basketball coach at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Hey, Hoopheads, we all hate ankle sprains, and they happen way too often. Ankle injuries are the number one sports-related injury. Arise is trying to change that. With the iFast, your athletes get preventative protection and full mobility. Athletes no longer need to wear bulky braces that limit performance and give mediocre protection. Anyone playing sports should be using these products. Keep your athletes in the game. Don't wait for them to get hurt to take action. Visit www.arise.com, spelled A-R-Y-S-E, and use the code HOOPHEADS to get 20% off the future of performance. That's A-R-Y-S-E.com with promo code HOOPHEADS to get 20% off.
Evaluate whoever you're going to work with and try to cast a vision for them of who you think they can become, and all of a sudden, they believe you.
Bill Ferreira is entering his fourth season as an assistant coach for the University of New Mexico women's basketball program after spending the previous two seasons at the University of Florida. In his three seasons at New Mexico, Ferreira has helped lead the Lobos to a 64-35 record overall. In his first 2 years, the Lobos won at least 20 games and made an appearance in the WNIT as well. While at Florida, Ferreira was primarily responsible for overseeing the development of guards as well as coordinating camps and clinics for the Gators. Prior to his time at Florida, Ferreira spent two seasons at George Washington University, where he was instrumental in recruiting, player development, strength and conditioning, as well as working with post players. Ferreira also spent three seasons at Hofstra University and at Central Michigan, where he helped lead both programs to outstanding success. Ferreira, originally from Brooklyn, New York, graduated from the University of Florida with a bachelor's degree in business management in 2003 before earning a master's degree in sports management in 2005. Don't miss our free Hoopheads Pod webinar series on Thursday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern. If you miss a live webinar, you can buy lifetime access to any of our previous webinars for $4.99 on the Hoopheads Pod website. If you're focused on improving your coaching and your team, we've got you covered. Visit hoopheadspod.com/webinars to get registered. Make sure you check out our new Hoopheads Pod network of shows, including Thrive with Trevor Huffman, Beyond the Ball, the CoachMaze.com podcast, Players Court, Bleachers and Boards, and our team-focused NBA podcasts, Cavalier Central, Grizz and Grind, Knuck If You Buck, The 305 Culture, and Blazing the Path. We're looking for more NBA podcasters interested in hosting their own show, centered on a particular team. Shoot an email to info@hoopheadspod.com if you're interested in learning more and bringing your talent to our network. Have a pen and paper in hand as you listen to this episode with Bill Ferreira, assistant women's basketball coach at the University of New Mexico. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are pleased to welcome to the podcast from the University of New Mexico, women's basketball assistant coach, Bill Ferreira. Bill, welcome to the Hoopheads podcast.
What's going on, guys? Glad to be on today with you guys.
Absolutely. We are excited to have you on, be able to dig into all the things that you've been able to do in the game of basketball. Want to work our way up to your current position with New Mexico, but start by going back in time to when you were a kid. Tell us a little bit about how you got started in the game of basketball. What are some of your earliest memories of the game?
Man, you know, it's a fun one. My journey is very different than I'd say most Division I coaches. I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, playing CYO ball and all that kind of stuff, but playing in a driveway. And in Brooklyn, you have the concrete everywhere, right? So we had the slanted concrete driveway that's going down, and then the milk crate basketball hoop tied to my stoop up top. So I, so at an angle, so I never developed a shot because of that, but my handles and my passing ability, was highly developed because if you can dribble down a driveway at a slant, and you can pass to people in a six by 15 driveway, then you're going to probably be a pretty good passer. And, my basketball journey was an interesting one. Played a lot of, pickup games and that sort of stuff. You're growing up in the city, like that's what you do. You play in the park. And, we moved to Florida right before I started high school. And that's kind of where my basketball playing days, came to a halt, broke my wrist, got cut from every high school team I tried out for. And I tried out every single year. And so, you look at my resume, you don't see a playing career down there because I never did play.
This is the third week in a row.
Went from there to the University of Florida and basically turned that into a stellar intramural basketball career. And that's basically it as far as playing is concerned. But that's my earliest memories are playing in the driveway with my brothers and everybody in the, playing in the park and all that kind of stuff. And that's where the love of the game came from. And then the New York Knicks are on TV and really good, back then it's the Ewing Knicks and the Pat Riley Knicks. And so grew up watching every single game of the Knicks back then. And so that's really where the game started for me.
Yeah, that's a good time to be a New York Knicks fan. A little tortured maybe, but certainly not as tortured as it's been in recent history. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, no, it was fun to watch a winner, man. And you know what? It's character building, man. You watch, you're always almost there. You think that you really have a chance every single year when you don't, because Jordan's out there. you got two, three out there ripping your heart out eventually. But it was definitely an awesome time to be a basketball fan in New York. And it was a cool time to be a basketball fan as a kid because I got to watch MJ, go through the league.
Yeah, we can relate to that for sure here in Cleveland. I think he beat us multiple times and took away our opportunity to be able to win titles as well. So we feel your pain for sure. And I think everybody in the league felt it. And just getting a chance to watch The Last Dance made it, that was so enjoyable for me to go back and just kind of relive those moments and see some of those things in the doc that were just so interesting and exciting. I wanted to ask you a question that you brought up when you talked about having an intramural team at the University of Florida. Did your intramural team have any creative names? You guys come up with any creative names for your team? I have the best one, and I have never shared this on the podcast. It was not my team, but it was another team. So I'm going to let you share yours, and then I'm going to come back at you with the one that I know of.
What's sad about all of that, right? Like my best and most fun intramural teams were like, our co-ed teams. And, right. And so we would always have like, okay, these two girls played on, wherever D1 and now they're in grad school or something like that. And so we were able to compete in that regard, with the lame athletes like me out there. our names were just boring all the time. It was like whatever grad program we're in. So I got no funny story for you here, man. It's rough. What do you got for us?
All right, so this was a team that when I was at Kent State playing, we had a graduate assistant who had played on the team at Kent, and he played with a couple other guys and some football players, and the name of their intramural team was At Will, and I always just thought that was I'm like that is a very subtle but very intimidating name is to be At Will. So I always enjoyed, whenever I'd be like, hey man, how'd your team do? He goes, oh man, we just, it was At Will. We just won whenever we wanted. So that was kind of fun.
I love it.
Mine was Sean Kemp's kids. We
All
named
right,
ourselves
there you go.
Sean
All right,
Kemp's
well, there
kids.
You at least tried to interject some humor in there. That's good. That's a positive.
Listen, man, I would have normal good stuff for you, but no, not in that regard. The intramural stuff, the worst stuff with the intramural stories that we'll get at, and I'm sure you can edit all this kind of stuff out, is like, you know, we go and one time there's a timeout and we're down like 30 or something like that. And we're playing like a legitimate team with all these guys could be, when you're at the University of Florida, like all these guys are like, could start on D2s and stuff.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
and so like we're down 30 and we call a timeout or whatever. And they're literally like, all they wanted to talk about in the timeout was how we needed to, you know, break the press spreader and all this kind of stuff. When legitimately we had no shot. Like, why are we strategizing right now? Like you're down 30 at like 10 minutes into the game. So like those are hilarious memories.
So was that the beginning of your coaching career?
Hey, great question on that one. No. It shortly after that, I did start coaching we started an AAU team in Gainesville, Florida. And, you know, I was a graduate assistant, you know, for the women's team at Florida, worked in the video room for Billy D, on the men's side before that. And so my coaching career started with, 7 and 8 year olds, you know, and then 7th and 8th graders after that. And, I don't know, man, I was just always busy. You know, I didn't have your normal college career where you're just like there and playing Madden and hanging out and going out and partying and stuff like that. I just always had something. And so it was a full-time job for basketball for me as a student and as a grad student. That's how I treated it. Everything was either an internship or a job in the video room or something like that. It was always something to set up the next thing and to start my path as a coach. And I didn't know it was to be a path as a coach. Like at that point I was legit, you know, Mike, I was trying to be the GM of the New York Knicks. And, you know, and that's how it all started, trying to figure out a way to fix my franchise, man. That's what it was.
Well, let's put it this way. Based on the hires that they've had, I'm not sure that you couldn't have done a better job coming in there with no experience as a college sophomore.
Yeah, tell me about it, man. Hey, listen, we can talk for hours about the Knicks. We got better. I'm telling you right now, you don't want me to go down a dark path on this.
We may end up doing it at some point. We may have to spend the last 5 minutes talking some Knicks basketball before we can do that, man.
Get me angry before I go to sleep. That's good.
Right. There you go. We'll get you all juiced up before you got to go and try and get some rest. So what's the genesis of you thinking that coaching is going to become something that is going to become your profession? When does that start to kick in for you? Is that some point when you're coaching the 7 and 8 year olds, the 7th and 8th graders, when you start working underneath the college programs at Florida? Just when does it kick in for you that, hey, not only is this something that I like to do at this particular moment in my life, but this is something that I might want to pursue as a profession?
You know, that's a great question. I haven't ever had to answer that question. The moment, though, was when I first became empowered by an assistant coach at the University of Florida, and her name was Shell Daly. She's now the head of IMG Academy's basketball program. And, you know, it was like I've been doing that thing for 2 years in the video room, you know, at Florida, and I've got internships, and I worked for the, you know, in the NBA for the Charlotte Bobcats for a summer in basketball ops, and I'm doing all this stuff. And I'm just kind of it's like busy work, though. You know, it wasn't coaching. It was just like doing things and, you know, always saying, you know, yes to everybody. And the answer to every question back then was no problem. And you know, for me, Shell Daly came up to me one day and she basically said, like, Bill, like, I really think you could be a coach someday. And I had never thought it before. So it really just took that nudge. And she was, you know, a great mentor to me, you know, and played at Texas, was the head coach at TCU. Like she, you know, and then she's an assistant at Florida. So it just opened my eyes. It kind of shocked me. You know, so at that moment, it changed everything for me. I went from, oh yeah, I'm going to do this and I want to work in sports and I want to be the GM of the Knicks to like, oh wow, this is real. Like somebody believes in me for real. You know, and then all of a sudden I start getting more responsibilities and Carolyn Peck is the head coach at the time. And, you know, she had won a national championship and coached in the WNBA and she started giving me scouts, you know, to work on and stuff. And one of our, assistant coaches became very sick and missed a whole week of prep leading up to us playing Candace Parker's, Tennessee teams. Okay. And I was, you know, at the time, just basically as a video coordinator before we had video coordinators, right? I was a graduate assistant, but I was the video coordinator. And so it was like next man up situation. Shell had empowered me earlier in the year and I was all in now. I'm going to try to be a coach. And, you know, one of the assistants got sick. I had to do the Tennessee scout and we went to Knoxville and beat Candace Parker on her senior night. And right at that moment, I was like, oh, crap, maybe I'm good at this, you know, and so we went to the NCAA tournament that year, turn around. And, you know, now you don't have a job right now. It's real. You know, I got to figure it out now. What's the real next step? And, you know, basically, I had just met my wife at that point, didn't know it, but we had just started dating. And it's like, wow, do I really want to move and leave this and be a coach? And hi, baby. Told you I'd get interrupted.
Yeah, there you go. They're good. Yeah, that's good.
I can watch my basketball downstairs, baby. Yes. Okay, I'll come watch it with you. She wants to watch the Heat game.
Hey, who doesn't? Good for her.
Okay, so this is what we got. Basically, the gist of this is, you know, I just met my wife in a new relationship, but I knew it was good. You know, do I leave and do all this? And I'm like, maybe I should just stay in Gainesville and just work minimum wage doing this basketball stuff for a little bit, for as long as I can. And out of nowhere, I get a call on my cell phone from Nell Fortner. And, you know, she's an Olympic gold medal winning coach now calling me on my cell phone and offering me a job. So, you know, there it just snowballs, man. And once you're empowered by somebody, it's amazing what that does for a young kid. And for me, it really changed my life.
And so for you, what was it about coaching that attracted you? Because obviously you're in the film room and you're going through and you're learning offenses and defenses and you're dissecting that film, but it's clearly different when you get out and you're coaching on the floor. So what was it about coaching initially that really you said, man, I love this. I can see myself doing this. Besides being empowered with confidence by some people that you had a lot of respect for, what was it about the actual process of coaching that you really loved?
Oh, man, that started at Auburn, because then I get to Auburn and, you know, the third assistant, you know, quits a week in. You know, so now I'm interim third assistant at Auburn as a 22-year-old kid. And now I'm actually allowed to be on the floor. You know, so it started when you get to see somebody improve, and then you get to see somebody like look to you for guidance on the court. And for me, and you guys heard the beginning of my story, you know, for me, I was like, are these people going to listen to me? I mean, I'm in the SEC. You know, these are elite level athletes. We have DeWanna Bonner, who's now like considered one of the greatest WNBA players of all time. You know, but here she is asking me to, you know, come up with some shooting drills for her. You know, so that was when I really knew. It was like, okay, they are going to listen to me, because guess what? They want to be better. So if you can help them improve, man, that's just a cool feeling to me. And so I just thought, hey, man, this is really just about the work. Put in the work. When it comes down to it, once you get down to on that floor, I mean, it doesn't matter what your playing resume was. It basically is just, what do you know? And guess what? Like, what you know is extremely controllable. I mean, especially now, man, if you're a young coach listening to this and you want to be a coach and you think you don't know anything, don't worry. Give yourself 2 weeks and plow through some YouTube. Right. And next thing you know, you can be an expert on anything you want. So, yeah, that's what it – I mean, for me, that's when it started, just being on the floor with you know, a great player in DeWanna and her just basically saying, here's a blank canvas, man. Like, help me get better.
So at that time, how did you go about building your base of knowledge so that you felt confident enough to be able to talk to that level of athlete, as you just said? What did you do to go about building – your knowledge base, and then as a result of that, building your confidence? Because I can definitely see, I think that's something that all coaches sometimes struggle with, regardless of what level you're coaching or who you're coaching with. I think that if you go into it and you're prepared, you can overcome maybe some of that self-doubt. But I think no matter what level you get to, there's always some degree of that doubt creeps in. So how did you overcome that as a 22-year-old?
I just never let it even come into my mind. I would call it irrational confidence.
Nice.
I mean, it's, you know, as soon as I was, when I was there, you know, I would think it, right, when I'm by myself at night, okay? you know, I would be like, man, like, do I belong? That kind of thought, right? And then immediately, I don't know, maybe my mom raised me this way, right? Like, okay, do more, right? Like, whatever, like, just be better. Same thing, like, you know, when I was trying out for the high school team, okay, well, it's not just like sulk and not be good. Like, okay, freaking work on your game, try out next year. You don't get it, try out again. Like, I don't know, man, a lot of going from failure to failure. So what I did was like, get there, think about it. Yeah, doubt's there, but I just told myself to shut up. And then, you know, we're on the Hoop Heads podcast, right?
That's right.
So, you know, the reason why at a young age I was getting these opportunities was because the coaches would come to the video room, and every time they would come in there, it wasn't a young guy just, you know, sitting around doing nothing. I was watching, you know, always had a project. You know, that was just like in my head, like I'm at the time, and I'm just thinking of some of the ones that I worked on back then because I still have them. I did a season long edit, and this is at 21 years old, season long edit of the Mike D'Antoni Phoenix Suns playbook. Okay, for myself. Now young guys are doing this like with YouTube in mind and try to be a basketball influencer or whatever. Like I was doing it to try to teach myself the offense.
Right. Right.
So like, that's what I did. So like with Dewana, right? So I would go in with Dewana and shoot with her and assistant coach Kerry Cremines at the time. And, you know, we'd be in there rebounding for her and putting her through shooting drills and stuff. And I'm like, okay, well, who does she play like? And who does she look like to me? And who could she be in the league? And so like, I don't know, go back to the Knicks talk, right? Like I had an NBA background. And so like, I would just like be like, okay, well, at that time I was like, Dewan, I need to watch some Stacey Augman. That's who I need to watch. You know, I need to watch some Plastic Man stuff for Dewan. I need to watch, like, that's the way I was thinking. And that's how I always have been. And so I don't know, just kind of critically think, evaluate, you know, whoever you're going to work with and then, you know, try to cast a vision for them of who you think they can become. And all of a sudden, you know, they believe you. Because you've invested time yourself, right? They could tell, like, I'm not just sitting there with Dewana and coming up with creative shooting drills and clapping and telling her she's awesome. It was, you know, that. And then I would show her, hey, D, like, here's something that I think you would benefit from. Have you watched this freshman from Texas named Kevin Durant? Okay, here's 200 of clips of a freshman on the men's side that she had never watched before. So, you know, that's kind of how I went about it.
So at that point, how much film are you watching in a typical week at that point in your career?
I can't even quantify it. you know, I already teased the fact that, you know, I had met my wife right around that time, right? Well, she stayed back in Gainesville at the time. Okay. She did not move with me to Auburn. So I'm there and I'm in a relationship and I'm very serious about it. Okay. So I'm doing nothing, right? Like I'm not like going out on the weekends or anything like that as a, you know, a young guy. Like I am literally in the office, first one in, last one out, and last one out meant like whenever the hell I wanted to go home, which was, what am I going to go home to? There wasn't streaming services, Netflix, all that kind of stuff. I was broke. The best thing I had going was sit there and watch every single game because I had DirecTV like in the office. So, I mean, I'd be there till 10. I would DVR everything I could. I would record everything I could. And then I'd get back into the office the next day at about 7. And that's just how it would be on repeat every day, 7 days a week.
Did you have a favorite guy or two or female player or two that you really like to break down and look at what they did out on the floor and then pass that along to your players? Was there somebody that stood out that you really, really appreciated watching for whatever reason, whether it was footwork, technique, just the way they played the game?
It depended on the type of player, right? So like my favorite shooter to break down was JJ Redick. And this was during his Duke days. Okay. You would just, it didn't take long to watch him and just be in awe of how quickly he could get his shot off, how many different types of ways he could shoot. You know, post players, it was different. You know, if I would always try to like somehow just steal an NBA guy for some of our, you know, especially earlier in my career, like okay, here, it wasn't Twitter yet, right? So they didn't have highlights of like today. They could go on right now, live during this game, and a freshman shooter on our team could be like, oh my God, Bill, did you see Duncan Robinson? Like, they didn't even know who Duncan Robinson was, you know, like, or whoever at the time, JJ Redick, right?
Right, right, right. Because
there wasn't highlights. So they had to watch the game live. You know, so I don't know, man. It was just everybody was different, but I just remember watching hours and hours of Kevin Durant, JJ Redick. You know, I loved breaking down Shane Battier defensive stuff. But those were like, you want to take my mind back to the Auburn days and early Central Michigan days. That was some of the stuff I was looking at.
What were one or two things that maybe right out of the gate that you struggled with as a coach, either from a standpoint of maybe it was an aspect of coaching that you didn't love right away, or maybe it was something that you weren't necessarily the best at when you first started that you feel like you've gotten better at over the course of your career?
Defensive teaching. You know, when I first started, and you could ask anybody that's known me my whole career, all I wanted to do was try to figure out how to score 100 points a game.
Did you study tape of Paul Westhead?
It was Westhead, yeah. That's how I came up with what we ended up going with at Central Michigan. You know, we ended up finishing fourth in the country in scoring in year two at Central Michigan, using a hybrid of Westhead stuff, the 7 seconds or less stuff with D'Antoni that I told you I had studied, and then Vance Wahlberg's dribble drive stuff. We basically created like a no huddle version of those three things. And that's, you know, we ended up averaging 88 points a game for most of the year. You know, so like that back then, right? Back then, you know, that young version of myself that thought he was, you know, more than he actually was, couldn't have taught a defense. Like I couldn't have gone into a practice, right? If I got a head job back then or something like early, regardless of the level, I wouldn't have even been able to teach any of that stuff. So it wasn't until, you know, years down the road where, you know, you go places and you get different responsibilities and all that. And then I started realizing, okay, I want to put my eye on the defensive side of the ball. So, offensive stuff was number one for me, which is ironic, right? Because I told you I'm a Knicks fan, and
right.
Riley's Knicks, all they cared about was the defensive end.
Right, exactly.
You know, but I don't know why. That was just where my eye was always on the offensive end. How could I improve a player? How could I spread the floor and create spacing and pace so that we could score more? That's really all my mind was on. So, yeah, I couldn't teach defense for anything when I was a young man. And, like,
so
people made fun of me about it.
What created that shift? Like, what was it? What was the impetus for saying, hey, I've got to get better at teaching defense? Was it somebody that came to you with that? Was it a case where you were given more responsibility on the defensive end of the floor? What changed that perspective for you?
I was tired of going to NITs. I mean, that's the truth. I mean, it was like, you know, you average, you know, in the 80s and you're exciting and you're always answering questions about your offense. And then you're getting bounced in the first or second round of the conference tournament because it's grind it time on day two of a conference tournament. You know, your kids are tired. You can't shoot. You know, it's just the reality of the situation. You're going to win games in the 60s and maybe low 70s if you're lucky and you shoot well. So, you know, I had to learn the hard way. We were really, really good at Hofstra after the Central Michigan years. We went to NITs. But we had NCAA tournament talent, and we had two teams that should have been in the NCAA tournament then. We were like RPI 11 for most of the year in one of my Hofstra years, but the defensive side just wasn't there. So, you know, it wasn't until I got to GW and, you know, watched, I really took a step back and was humbled by the staff that we had. I had, you know, the staff that we had, I still will contest is one of the greatest staffs in the history of women's college basketball. Okay. And I am by far the run of the litter, okay, on this staff. We had Jonathan Sippas, the head coach of Wisconsin, the head coach of GW, okay? We had Megan Duffy as our associate head coach, who's now the head coach at Marquette, okay? We had Diane Richardson, who has won multiple national championships at the high school level, you know, and now she's the head coach at Towson, took them to the NCAA tournament for the first time in their history, and then me. You know, in addition to that, our Adobo won a national championship at Notre Dame. Our graduate assistant is now an assistant at St. Bonaventure. Like, we had a staff, and everybody. I just was able to sit back and listen more than I had to talk. So then I started to realize, like, okay, now I can, you know, see how we should teach defense. Maybe I should put my eyes on the defensive side because Sip had his mind on the offensive side. So it was fun, man. We won championships, plural. And so, yeah, that's when it started.
All right. I want to jump backwards for a second and just kind of go through the saga of your different stops and just maybe how you got to each one of those places and what prompted you to go to each one. So let's go back to, how do you go to Central Michigan? What does that process look like for getting you there? And then we'll jump from there to Hofstra next.
Okay. Well, that one was a shocking one to me, right? So I was 1 year at Auburn. And in my mind as a young assistant or whatever, young video coordinator, I thought that there was, like, you know, an order to things, right? You go from being a graduate assistant to being a video coordinator, then you'd be the Dobo, then you'd be the third assistant, then you'd be the second, then the associate, then you get a head coaching job. That's what I thought back then. I didn't know anything. You know, but after 1 year, one of our assistant coaches, Sue Guevara, gets the head job at Central Michigan. Okay. And, you know, I was very close with Sue, and Sue is a head coach at the all-time winningest head coach at the University of Michigan. Then she, you know, comes to Auburn as an assistant, gets the job at Central. The day that she basically comes back from getting the job, I go into her office basically just to congratulate her. And also, like, I was like, okay, I'm going to try to be her Dobo because that's the next step, right? Like, I'm a video coordinator. Now I'm going to ask Sue if I can go and be her video, her Dobo. So I walk into her office. I say, hey, Sue, you know, if you need a Dobo, like, jokingly, if you need a Dobo, you know, let me know or whatever. And she goes, I don't need a Dobo, Mr. Bill. You're coming with me as a coach. I'll talk to you later. And I was like, what? yeah. And here's an odd thing, right? You want to talk about, like, a true how things work. Okay. And I've told this story to a couple of people before, but I think it's important for a lot of people to hear this part. The next day. Okay. So you get offered a job from somebody that's on your current staff. Well, I'm the video coordinator at Auburn, right? And so I need to, like, talk to Nell and tell her, like, okay, hey, I'm Sue wants me to come as a coach. Like, what do you think? All that kind of stuff. Even though in my mind, I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to be a coach. I got to go. And then Nell offers me an assistant job at Auburn. Okay. Like, how did that happen? and you know, but, like, for me as a young assistant and all that, like, you want to talk about the doubt and all, I don't know if I wasn't ready or whatever, or any of that kind of stuff. It was more of like a loyalty to Sue. Like, Sue gave me my first shot in that, you know, as a coach. Like, I knew that she believed in me, and I was just like, you know what, I'm going to go do this with Sue. And, you know, this is going to be awesome and, you know, whatever, even though I don't even know where Michigan is. I've never been there before, any of that stuff. So that's how that happened, man. And, you know, there's a lot of steps in the way there and how that happened, all that stuff. Literally that day when I make the decision not to stay at Auburn and to, yep, I'm going with Sue, that night I proposed to my wife. And because I'm like, she had moved to Auburn at that point. I'm like, there is no way I'm about to tell her. She just moved from Florida to Auburn, and now I'm
now you're taking to now Michigan. You're taking her to Mount Pleasant, Michigan.
Yeah, without a proposal, not a chance. So now I proposed to her. She said yes. We moved to Michigan, and then you know, a lot of awesome stuff happened in Mount Pleasant. We were very lucky to make that decision.
So what was it like getting the first real opportunity to coach on the floor as an assistant? Just what was the adjustment like in terms of your mentality and just kind of your day-to-day, what you did as part of your responsibilities?
Well, that first year, very different than in year two. Okay. Year one, I knew my role. I was the young guy. We had two experienced assistants on the staff. And I was just there to, you know, basically, like, bring some energy and occasionally be a practice player. That's what I was in year one. So there wasn't any sort of real good stuff happening year one coming out of young Bill Ferrara. Okay. But I wasn't satisfied with that. Okay. So I I went into the same whatever mode you talked about earlier, and I was like, okay, I don't want to just be this guy right here that doesn't really have opinions, but I don't really have a way to fix that. So I took that off season and I made the biggest jump I have ever made in any short amount of time, mentally as a basketball coach. I studied that stuff I was telling you about. And, you know, then after I studied the West, you know, Westhead mixed with D'Antoni, mixed with Wahlberg, and we came together with the system and I proposed that to Sue. And, you know, then I was like, okay, I know this. I am like, and it went from being a guy that wasn't really talking much in practice to I am running the offensive side of practices every day. You know, and I didn't have this stuff back then, but I was our offensive coordinator at 24 years old. And, you know, like that was an interesting jump, man. But here's the thing. I was confident. I knew what I was talking about and I believed in what I was talking about. And I taught it as if that was the only way to play basketball. That was how I taught our offense at Central Michigan. And then obviously, you know, the numbers back it up. We played with unbelievable pace and we scored a ton of points, and a lot of people ended up being pro players because of that kind of stuff. But I'd say the number one thing was I made that jump and studied and got better. And then because of that, I had the confidence like, okay, this is how we're going to play. And also I had a head coach in Sue that was like, hey guys, this is how we're going to play. Mr. Bill knows this stuff. We're going to score a lot of points. Let's do it. So that's how we did it. And so that was pretty cool as a young coach to get a chance to coach that much at that age.
Absolutely. I think what you just spoke to, and you've mentioned it twice, I think is the fact that once you know your stuff and you're confident that you know your stuff and you can back up the fact that you know your stuff, it gives you a tremendous amount of confidence to go out there and teach. And I think that anybody in any walk of life, whether you're a coach or you're in some other profession, when you walk into a meeting or when you walk into a conference room, when you walk into a relationship, when you're prepared for that, you end up having a lot better success. And when you're not quite as prepared as you probably should be, it becomes a lot more difficult. And so I think by you putting in the time that you did to study the offensive side of the ball and do all those things allowed you to walk in there and be confident. How did the players who were there both years, how did they react to sort of that change in you? How did they perceive you differently from that first year to that second year? And did it take some adjustment from that relationship between you and the players?
Interesting, I guess, dynamic there was that, you know, year one, when you're there, we didn't have very much talent, okay? And it was just like one of those situations where you always hear about like a coaching staff, you take over a job, right? And you want to hope that you can turn over the roster as quickly as you can and bring in your players or whatever. Well, we did that. Okay. So the year one to year two thing was just natural. We didn't like kick all these kids off or anything like that. It was just like, we had seniors, they graduated. We brought in a ton of freshmen. They were talented and here we go. And so really, it was just a mix of, there was only a handful of kids that played in year one that were going to play in year two. The rest, all the new kids, you know, and the new ones that we brought in, well, they didn't know that first year version of me. And so, you know, the returners just like, whoa, this is different. This is fun. Like we're going to play this way. Like, okay. So we went from playing a motion offense, like pass and screen away, reverse the ball kind of offense where we were, you know, horrible, 6-23 and we weren't scoring a lot of points, and to complete 180 and, you know, no huddle, pushing it up the floor, makes and misses, shooting quick threes. We were second in the country and made threes, you know, so these guys, you know, the returners like, okay, it didn't take much for them to change. And then the new ones had no idea. So they just thought I was like some crazy guy that talks about all the time. But yeah, that's a good question. The dynamic was actually changed because the roster changed.
Yeah, it's a fun way to get up and down the floor and play. And I'm sure the players appreciated the opportunity to just get up and down and get the ball up in the air and play offense and do all those kinds of things. And you as the coach being able to put that in and be, as you said, what maybe wasn't known at the time as the offensive coordinator, but to be given the opportunity and to be given the role of offensive coordinator, to have that responsibility placed on you as a young coach, I'm sure dynamically increased your ability to, you know, to just maximize who you were as a coach. And so as you look forward and you start going through, what did you learn about how a head coach should assign roles within a coaching staff? And you can maybe not even address this directly to Central Michigan, but just kind of look over the totality of your career. How do you think that a head coach, what's the best way in your mind to sort of figure out what the roles and responsibilities are going to be for assistant coaches as part of a staff?
Yeah, man, I think that the number one thing that you can do and the best thing that you can do as a head coach is empower your assistant coaches, and that'll make them thrive in whatever role you give them. Okay. I've been really, really lucky, man. Like the head coaches that I have worked for are all unbelievably successful. And, you know, you can name them all, but as from Sue, all-time winningest coach at Central Michigan now and at the University of Michigan. She's getting a court named after her at Central, probably going to have a statue there, like went to the Sweet 16, to, you know, then to Hofstra, the all-time winningest coach there, then to GW and SIP winning championships. Amanda Butler at Florida is amazing. And then now to, you know, to Mike, you know, here at New Mexico, like each one of them is confident in themselves enough to empower their assistants to do their job. And so I think that that's, you know, what I've learned and the reason why I'm ready to take that jump and become a head coach now is I've learned from enough and seen them, you know, hey, give somebody a responsibility and let them crush it. And then also tell them that they're going to crush it. And then all of a sudden, next thing you know, they're good at it. I don't believe in equal opportunity accountability. I do not think that you can have staffs where every single person has their hand in the offense, every single person has their hand in the defense. I think what I've seen work, you know, is when there is somebody that has their eyes on the offense, there's an assistant coach that has their eyes on the defense, there's their assistant coach that has their eyes on, you know, whether it be rebounding or special teams or special situations, whatever you want to call it, because I think that when you give somebody that big of a responsibility as an assistant, you know, you're just going to be better for it. And as the head coach, then you can trust the assistants. You know, you can go to that person and be like, okay, you know, talk to me about offense, and they will be an expert at it. Instead of having three people or maybe five talking about the same things and everybody's talking and they all have different perspectives. You know, I just think that, you know, if you empower them and then you give them responsibilities and then hold them accountable to it, like then your staff's going to be better for it.
Have you talked to your head coaches about just what their mentality is or how they view that ability to empower assistant coaches? Because I think one of the things that we've had a chance to talk to people on the podcast about who have been head coaches, especially maybe in their first opportunity, if they were a young coach, being a head coach, that it's sometimes difficult to do what you just described, where if I'm probably what's made me successful as a coach is the fact that I'm very hands-on and detail-oriented and just thinking about the story of your story and just all the time that you spent studying film and improving your craft and doing all that stuff. And that's what most successful coaches end up doing. And so we've heard from a lot of coaches that, hey, my first experience, I wanted to micromanage everything. I wanted to micromanage my offense, my defense, my assistant coaches, all that. So I'm just curious if you've ever had a conversation with one of your head coaches or multiple head coaches about, I don't want to say the difficulty, but just the mentality that it takes to be able to release some of that responsibility to the assistants, even to the players, rather than micromanaging everything.
Yeah, actually, I think one of my strengths is that I can have blunt conversations with my bosses. And it's made me better because of it. So, I mean, I've literally talked to each and every one of them about this, you know, in different ways. And I'll say this, everybody's got different perspectives on it. I think everyone's different. If you want to be a micromanager, then, and that's going to help you be the most successful as a head coach, then do it. I'm just saying what I've seen work, and what I've seen not work. the best. And you asked me the question of like, what would maybe in the future, like, what do you think would, how would you handle it and all this? And what's the best way to do it after all these stops? That's the best way to do it, in my opinion. I think that the best ones are self-aware. They know what they know their gaps, they know their strengths, and then they hire to their gaps. And so like the best thing, I had an amazing conversation with Amanda Butler. And if you haven't had her on your pod yet, like you need to, she's amazing. And Butler was like, listen, Bill, I'm going to give you Underneath Out of Bounds because I hate Underneath Out of Bounds. I don't want to coach it, basically. That's why she gave me like carte blanche, like here, you know what, you call the Underneath Out of Bounds plays, you put them in, whatever. But she's like, but I love doing player development. And especially guard development. So she's like, you're going to coach the guards, but I'm going to coach them with you. And like, that's the only head coach that's ever said that to me. And it was interesting to me to hear that, but it's true. And she's like, listen, I gotta have some stuff that I like to do as a head coach.
Right.
And so she loved it. She would work out the players as if she was an assistant. And, you know, and I know that not a lot of head coaches do that. So, you know, I don't know. I think that was good perspective. And I've talked to all of them about it in different ways. Mike is the, by far, you want to talk about spectrums, micromanager versus non-micromanager, you know, freelance. You know, Mike is on a 10 if a micromanager is a 1. And he does a great job of hiring to his gaps. And so he always puts the staff together. This is Mike Bradbury, head coach of the University of New Mexico, who I'm talking about. You know, he listens to everybody. Always ask for opinions. It's a very Steve Kerr-like philosophy where it's like anybody can say something in a meeting. And you know what? If what you say makes sense, I'm going to go with it. And, you know, you got to be really, really secure. And I think what you're describing with some of the first-year head coaches, a lot of people aren't secure with themselves and a lot of people aren't self-aware. And, you know, so that's what happens. And that's why I think a lot of young coaches and first-time head coaches fail because they're insecure and then they don't trust their assistants. And then they, next thing you know, you have a environment on a staff that's toxic. And if you don't think that the rest of the staff can feel that, and then the players can, you know, don't feel that, then you're crazy.
Yeah. There's no doubt that there's a trickle down effect that if you don't get that from the head coach, that everybody feels that pressure. And I mean, I've been on that from a playing side of it. On the coaching side, I was very fortunate. When I coached in high school, I was a part of the same staff. We had the same group of guys who were together for like 12 or 13 years. A very unique situation at the high school level to be able to have that kind of thing. But it was just one of those situations where, just as you described, head coach trusted the assistants, assistants trusted the head coach, and everybody kind of knew what their role was. And as a result of that, you ended up having a positive feeling across the staff, and then that positive feeling was transferred down to the players as well. And when you can get that, I think that's when you do have success. And like you said, when you're a young coach, if you don't have that sense of self-awareness, it can put you in a difficult spot. And it's amazing the number of coaches that said that I've become way more successful by releasing some of those responsibilities, some of the things that I felt like I had to do. When I let those go and let my assistants take over those responsibilities, and I talked to them about what those responsibilities were that I wanted them to take over. And even when I passed along some of the responsibility to my captains or the players on the team and took those things off my plate, that's when I really started to develop my program and have success. And I think that basically what the stories that you've told tonight have echoed that sentiment, that in order for you to really have success, you have to empower the people that you've had enough confidence in to hire in the first place.
No doubt about that, man. That's good stuff. That's good
All right.
Stuff.
So let's talk about the transition. How do you go from Central to Hofstra? What's the story there?
You know, it was time for me to make a change. I needed to grow in different ways. And, you know, this was a weird one, but I wasn't applying, you know, at a certain level, you don't really apply anymore to jobs, right? It's like you see a job opening at the Division I level, you have your boss call or you have a mentor call or whatever, right? So Sue called a couple places for me and, you know, I interviewed at a couple places and basically at the Final Four, I interviewed with Penn State and Hofstra. and thought I was going to get both of them. Basically, I was like, yep, I'm about to be a Big Ten assistant. Here we go. 25 years old. Did not get it. And was like shocked and devastated for a minute about that. But I had already made my mind up that, you know what, it's time for me to move on. And Hofstra came and offered me, and it's back home in New York. And, you know, really would have been like an awesome, we didn't have kids at the time, awesome place to live. And it would be similar responsibility. So it was like, you know, she was coming in, you know, she needed a change offensively. She was coming in saying like, hey, why don't you come here and help me, you know, change the offense. We need to score some more points and all that. So that's why I did it. I was, you know, essentially it wasn't a move for money or anything like that. It was basically just like a new experience, an opportunity to work with other people and see the way people do it differently. And then obviously get to be back home in New York. And so that's why we ultimately made the move to Hofstra.
What did you learn in the time that you were there? What's something that you took away from that that you've carried with you since?
Man, I think one of the coolest things that you learn from a spot like that, where you have so many different types of people, right? It's New York. Nobody comes to your games. Okay. They don't care. They got so much stuff to do, right? So you're playing in front of nobody all the time. Couldn't be more different than what I'm coaching in front of now at New Mexico, where we average 5,000 a game. You know, listen, it's so, you gotta realize it's about the players, and you know, it's, and they are playing for each other. There was literally like 15 people at our game sometimes, and it was just like their parents. And I just had forgotten that at a certain point. Like I was like still in that mode where it was like, oh man, we need to be so good at this so that we can score this amount of points so that we can win, so that blah, blah, blah. Like it was almost like a math problem to me. Well, what it taught me after year one there, where we were really good, I think we won like 19 games. I was just more about the X's and O's than I was about the players at that point. And it was a rude awakening for me at year one. And then unbelievable, I started building relationships with every single player, and it made me a transformative coach instead of a transactional one. So that's the thing I took from Hofstra, was it changed the way that I viewed coaching, period.
And so how did you then start to approach things differently? So day to day, what did that look like when you started to become transformational and you started to say, hey, I've got to have a bigger impact on these kids that are in front of me besides just helping them to score more points and becoming fourth in the country in offense? I really want to be able to build a relationship and impact them long term. What did you do differently day to day as a coach to build those relationships to allow you to have the kind of impact that you now were realizing that you wanted to have?
I started talking with them instead of talking to them. I mean, I think that was the number one thing. I was asking more questions than I was, you know, that I really genuinely wanted to get answers about. And it, you know, because as a young coach, like, and you're a male coaching women's basketball, sometimes it's just like, you know, the questions at first maybe were like, hey, you want to come in and work out, you want to do that? You know, it was always like a transaction. It was always like, you want to come do this so that we can get you better, so that we can be better, so, you know what I'm saying? So like, it was for me, the question started to ask about, you know, their family. Talk to them more about who they are as a person, what they're thinking about, what they're doing, you know, what do they think about what we're doing, you know, ask them for input. So it was a major change and a necessary one. Cause I think, you know, for me at that time, it was like, oh wow. Okay. So now they just, we had legitimate relationships, and now I could coach them a little bit differently during the games too.
When you say you could coach them differently in the game, do you mean that you could maybe push them a little bit harder because they knew where you were coming from, as opposed to before it was just this guy standing in front of them who seemed more distant and was just this authority figure?
Yeah, I think it, I was still viewed at that point as a young assistant though, right? So I don't even think they viewed me as an authority figure. It was just, you know, I would always push them, right? And try to push them. The results had changed. That's all that changed. You know, I was still coaching the same way I coached during the games, right? I'm not all of a sudden in the middle of a game going to ask them how they're feeling.
Right.
You know, however, it's going to be, hold on one second, Mike.
Sure.
Yeah. Give me a second. That's what happens, man. You got
it's all good, man. Trust me.
The 4 year old.
Trust me.
The 4 year old's a yeller. That's the problem.
There you go. Hey, we all got to. They all got their pro. They all got their own personalities. I know that better than anybody. So.
See now that.
Yeah, you got her in trouble, yep, man. I see, man. Yeah, it's all your fault.
It's me. Okay.
Dad messed it up.
That was transactional, right? I was trying to. I literally told her that I would basically be able to let her stay up a little bit if she let me do this interview.
There you go.
Okay, here we go. So back on our tangent here, I was basically talking about in-game and how those conversations changed. The conversations didn't change. The results changed because they trusted me more and maybe they liked me more or whatever. So, you know, maybe I was trying to push them the same way. It was just they heard me this time, right? And, yep. And I think that was really good for me to see as a young coach and helped me move from to the next stop as well.
All right. Let me ask you this. In game as an assistant coach, talk to me a little bit about what your role has been on the bench during games at your various stops. Has it always been similar? Have you been responsible for different things? Just talk to me about what you're doing during the game on the bench. What some of your responsibilities are as an assistant coach?
Obviously, each stop is different based on your head coach and what they need from you. Okay. So I had my eyes on the offensive end for most of my career. So I was keeping track of offensive efficiency. I was keeping track of our play calls. I was literally keeping track of points per possession for each play call. And for us running, you know, a no huddle up tempo system, you don't really have play calls, but you have like initial actions and entries, right? That's what I was tracking. So if we started our, you know, attack with a simple down screen rip, I wanted to see how often we were scoring off of that and how much we were scoring off of that. So for me, that's the stuff I've been tracking most of my career live on the bench. When I got to GW, essentially it was more of a different role on the bench.
Let's transition again and just talk to us a little bit about going from Hofstra to GW to work with Coach Sippas.
Truly, the coolest thing that has happened to me in my career was a chance meeting with him. We were at Boo Williams recruiting, and I had known that he was going to have an opening on his staff or that he had an opening on his staff. But I wasn't, you know, I was happy at Hofstra. We were in New York. My wife was working in the city. Like we loved living there. We just had our first child. It wasn't like I was looking to move. Okay. But I had a really great accidental meeting with him. Like one of these, basically the only way to describe it is a collision. We sat next to each other at Boo in a packed gym, striking up conversation just about basketball kind of stuff. I had totally forgotten that that Sue had introduced the two of us and basically like kind of said to Sip, like, hey, you need to help mentor this kid someday. Like, he's really good. This is my young guy when Sip was at Notre Dame. So we just started talking about stuff, and Sip just asked me a simple question, which was basically, you know, what was it like, you know, coaching against Elena Deldon? And I didn't know what the question was about, but it was kind of a weird question, but really he was trying to get a lot out of me at that point. We were just, you know, I had known that his best player was Jonquel Jones, who is now obviously in the WNBA and for the Connecticut Sun and a superstar. But he was asking me that question with Jonquel in mind. So we talked about Deldon, and I just happened to say, like, man, yeah, I would do this for JJ if I were you. You know, you need to look at this that Delaware's doing, all this kind of stuff. And then I started talking about working with Dewana Bonner and how, like, I thought that D and JJ were very similar and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, and a couple of days later, he called me, so that's just how that worked, man. Like it was a chance meeting. I wasn't trying to get a job or anything like that. And honestly, like I think he interviewed like 200 people, and you guys interviewed Sippas, so you know he's long-winded and very detail-oriented. So his interview process is like no other. I mean, it is a full vetting every night, 1 hour on the phone with him, asking, answering questions, watching the NBA playoffs with him, like while he's, you know, watching him in DC, I'm watching him in New York at the time, and eventually ends up with a job offer and that was instantly accepted. So that's how that ended up being. And man, was it an unbelievable decision by us.
All right. So what does that look like for the two seasons that you're there? What did you learn? What was the experience like? What made it so special?
Every single thing. I could do a whole pod on that, on those 2 years, man. First and foremost, I had the opportunity to coach the best post combination in the country, in Kyra Washington and Jonquel Jones. And both of them averaged a double-double. Jonquel was unbelievable and ended up being, you know, a top first-round pick in the WNBA. So got to coach unbelievable players. We won. I can count on both my hands how many games we lost in those 2 years. Like, we just won all the time. We just won everything. And the culture that he built, the players that we had on those championship teams were unbelievable. The staff, I've already talked about them, was unbelievable. We just, everything was clicking. Literally every single thing was clicking. He had created the perfect environment for winning and basically did, you know, what he had always done. He took the Notre Dame system and brought it to GW. And it just so happened that we struck gold with some talent, and you mix that together with the staff that we had, and you're cutting down a lot of nets. And that's what we did. I got a lot of net pieces hanging up.
So what does that look like from a culture standpoint? Like, what are some things that he does that you guys did while you were there that translate into a winning basketball program? Obviously, talent plays a huge part in that, but you also have to set up the environment to allow that talent to flourish. So what does that look like? What does he do? What did you guys do while you were there that made it such a special environment that allowed you guys to get all those
nets? An unbelievable high standard from the very first second you walk in the door. Your very first interaction with him, I don't want to say is going to be criticized, but you feel like you're being evaluated. And I'll tell you, it is the perfect environment for high achievers. And he really did an unbelievable job of accumulating high achievers. And every single person that he brought in, and that's where his, you know, I joked about the interview process. There's a reason why he does that. You can't be weak and work for SIP or play for SIP, because it's just not going to work. And I'm not saying like he's a grinder or anything like that. I'm saying he holds everyone accountable and sets a standard, holds you to a standard, communicates the standard, and then makes every single person in the organization want to improve, because you don't want to let them down. And that's, it was the perfect timing for me in my career, where I was just young enough to still, you know, really feel like I need to prove something. And also, like, you know, I needed to see, like, okay, am I as good as Megan Duffy, who's one of the best assistant coaches in the country and been to Villa 7 and all that kind of stuff? Like, hey, can I hang with the Diane Richardson? Like, that was, for me, that's what it was about. I was like, damn, like, everyone's better than me. Like, that literally, like, that was my first thought. I was like, okay, time to raise your level, dude. And I sure did. And I think he would attest to that, and everybody on our staff would attest to the fact that we all raised our levels, and that's why we were champions multiple times.
Yeah, there's no doubt that being in an environment where everybody is pushing everyone else, and pushing everyone else in a positive way, where it's not a cutthroat, I'm better than you, but it's a collegial, everybody's trying, yes, to get better and pushing one another because we're all so successful. Because I know that you can sometimes get into environments that have, like, I would bet it's probably a fine line where if the leader pushes or nudges things in one slight different way, that you could end up with this sort of cutthroat mentality where people are trying to achieve, but they're almost trying to do it at the expense of the person next to them, as opposed to what you're describing, which is great people who want to have tremendous success, but they also want to see the success of other people. And I would think as a coach that a lot of times that's something that not only do you have to work on to instill with your staff, but just thinking about player to player relationships and how that works, especially when you start talking about trying to have success at the highest level, you better have players who are A, competitive and pushing each other. And yet at the same time, when it comes time for everybody to go out on the floor and put on the uniform, that everybody's pushing in the same direction. So how do you achieve that? Is there something, I know there's no secret sauce, but what do you think is the key to be able to achieve the pushing of one another without it becoming cutthroat?
Man, hiring and bringing the right people into your organization. It's where it starts and ends. And he did that. Every single person that was a part of those GW years for SIP and with SIP, we all had the same mindset. If you just look at the roster and you look at the resumes of the roster, and I challenge anybody that's listening to this podcast, a fun little wormhole to go down. Go to the GW championship teams under SIPIS, okay, with the Jonquel Jones teams. Look at every single player's high school resume or whatever resume at the place they were before this, okay? It was state champions. It was we had a flag football champion and Heisman winner from Florida on our team. We just had winners, like everyone. You know, you got Megan Duffy, who, you know, won at every level, played the WNBA, but then won as a coach everywhere she'd been. Diane Richardson's winning national championships and, you know, at the high school level at Riverdale Baptist, but also then literally like starting successful businesses, you know, and running successful businesses her whole life. You know, every single person down the line, the roster, the staff, it was a perfect melting pot of you know, success. So that's where I would say it's all about who you allow in the room, and nobody better so far that I've worked with at picking the right people than that guy up there that's now up in Madison.
All right. So let me ask you this. You've obviously been on the interviewee side of the process, and you've had to answer questions from coaches who are looking to hire you. What have you learned about that process that, were you to ever get the opportunity to be a head coach, what have you learned about the interview process that you think would allow you to find the same type of people that you're describing here that have that winner's mentality, that are going to bring that desire to push one another to be their very best?
I think you have to ask more questions than you're comfortable asking. I mean, that's what I've learned in, and I can just, you know, I do get to hire people, right? I'm the lead recruiter at the University of New Mexico. So I'm a big part of I'm the gatekeeper in a lot of senses for who gets allowed in our room, right?
Right.
Well, I've made a lot of mistakes, you know, at every stop doing that. And most of the time when I've made a recruiting mistake, it is because I have not asked the right amount of questions, or the right questions, or the tough questions to the right people. So I think that that's what I've learned for, you know, when I do get my opportunity to become a head coach, when it's hiring, whether it's hiring a staff or, you know, allowing players to join our family, it's going to be, I got to ask more people more tough questions to make sure that we get it right. Everything matters with that kind of stuff, man. When you bring them on the on-campus interview, you can tell if the vibe's not right. We interviewed somebody who's a terrific coach. When we were at GW, we interviewed Megan Duffy, left. Okay. So she left to go to the University of Michigan. So we're interviewing coaches there. And me and Diane are Richardson are basically like, we better get this right, because we got something special here. So we just watched and observed, and we could tell if the vibe wasn't right in the interview, and the reason why was because we were honed in and locked in on making sure that we got it right. And I think so many times when people are hiring or in recruiting, they don't make sure that they get it right because they just want to get somebody. Well, I think it's the same thing when people hire people. Sometimes you just, oh man, you want to get someone because somebody told you to get someone and you don't do your homework or you're not paying attention. And man, did we get it right. When Duff left, we hired Melissa Dunn, and she's unbelievable. But we could have got it wrong had we not been paying attention to the vibes of the on-campus interviews.
All right, so let's take it to the recruiting piece of it. When you're going out and you're recruiting for the University of New Mexico, what are some things that you're looking for? I mean, let's go beyond. Obviously, there's a certain level of talent that you have to have in order to be able to play at that level. So let's kind of put that aside in terms of the basketball. But what are some of the intangible things that you look for in a player, and where do you go to find out what those intangible things are about the player? I'm sure you get some of it from watching them play. I'm sure you get some of it from talking to people who are around them. But what kind of questions do you ask? Who do you go to? And what are you looking for when you watch the player play beyond just their physical tools and their basketball skill?
Well, let me just lead with this right now. In the age of COVID, my goodness, is this a harder question to answer than it normally would be?
Oh, I'm sure. Absolutely.
Currently, I'm evaluating players only on videotape, on bad streaming video, on highlight tapes that their dad makes. It is a challenge, man. But I'll say this. My favorite thing to do is to go and watch a kid practice with their high school. Not go to an open gym where the coaches have, or you know, the high school coaches organized it and texted every coach they know, and then there's 15 coaches watching. But to just plan it in my schedule, figure out when it works for me to go to a practice, whether it be, hey, we're off on Wednesday, I'm flying to Los Angeles, I'm going to go watch this kid practice when no one else is watching. Because if that kid is not, you can tell a lot about watching a high school player practice. Because, you know, and I'll say this, you rarely get it wrong if you watch how they interact with all of their high school teammates on a day where no other high school, you know, no other college coaches are there, and it's just a normal day. Because guess what? Most of the time when they're with you, it's just a normal day. And those are the days that matter. So I've had a lot of success with evaluating players by just going to a Saturday morning practice or a random practice and watching them. More success doing that. And I find out more about a player doing that and talking to every single coach, assistant coach, the athletic trainer, everybody about them. The random, you know, high school dean that goes up to me and introduces himself to me at the game or whatever it is. I find those practices have been unbelievably valuable because you can find out what they're going to be like when it's tough for you.
What kind of questions do you ask those assistant coaches, the dean, the principal, a teacher, when you get an opportunity to do that? What kinds of things are you looking to find out when you have those conversations with those people?
Ultimately, what am I getting to is I want to know if they're self-motivated. Because I think self-motivated players end up having the most successful careers. If I need to, you know, text a kid every day to try to get them to come in and work out and put in extra work, yeah, I can help her get better, but you know, I don't really know what her ceiling's going to be like. The ones that I know have had the best careers, and I've been very fortunate to coach a lot of pros, you know, and a lot of, you know, all-time greats were at each school that I've been at. Those ones were just self-motivated. So that's what I want to know first and foremost. I think if you're self-motivated, then you're going to compete harder every day. I want to know how competitive they are and other stuff. That's the stuff I'm asking. Like, you know, does she play any other sports? You know, that's a good one for me. Has she ever played any other sports? Especially, you know, like one little clue that they drop sometimes, like a crumb that they'll drop is like, oh yeah, no, she used to play soccer. Man, was she good at soccer. Okay, well now I want to talk to that soccer coach. Like, you know, and I want to find out what she was like as a soccer player. You know, so that's the kind of stuff. Basically, if they're self-motivated and how much of a competitor they are, the rest of the stuff, there's obviously some red flag type of stuff. I want to know what kind of student they are. Most of the time, if they end up being a lazy student or a bad student, man, I'm telling you, they do not work out at the college level. I don't care if you're Harvard, you know, GW or New Mexico, don't matter what level of academic school you are, if they don't care about school, that to me, that tells me a lot about them. You know, and if they don't respect their teachers, they don't respect, you know, that tells me a lot about them. So you need to know the negative stuff too. But I, at the core, I want to get down to, do they compete and are they self-motivated?
Yeah, that self-motivation piece, I think, is so huge. And we've talked with other coaches about that at all levels. I think it's so important because, you know, especially when you talk about the transition from high school to college basketball, and we all know that there's a big leap, A, in the level of play, B, in the requirements in terms of hard work and what's expected. And there's always an adjustment for players going from high school to college. And if you are someone who doesn't love the game and aren't self-motivated to get better and improve, then it's very, very easy for, I think, college basketball to quickly become a job or have that feeling of drudgery if you don't love the game. And so I can see where that would be a hugely important point that you would want to try to find out about players before you bring them on campus and bring them into your culture and make sure that you have, as you said before, whether it's your staff or it's your players, having the right people in place solves a lot of problems before they even exist. When you have the right people on the ship, then it's a lot easier to get them to do the things that you want them to do so that you can have the success that you want to have. All right, let's talk about how you get to New Mexico. We'll talk a little bit about that and just give us an idea of how you got out to New Mexico after Sip left and went to Wisconsin. And then we'll talk a little bit about where we think your future lies.
Well, there's a stop that we're missing here. I left Sippus to go to the University of University of Florida, my alma mater.
Okay.
And he can talk for hours about this. By far the hardest decision I've ever had to make, and some people would think it's the easiest, right? Like, you're literally, I doubled my salary. You know, you're going back to your alma mater. I'm going closer to home, to Florida. Going to the SEC, like that, a lot of people would say that's a no-brainer. I was straight up bawling in his office, you know, when I had made the decision. I knew what I was leaving. I knew we had a special culture there. I knew we had a special staff. I knew we were about to win more championships in the years to come. You know, and so made that move to Florida, and, you know, and ultimately it was amazing for me. You know, you're back home at your alma mater and you are in the top 25 and you're, you know, in the NCAA tournament. And it was my dream job, man. If anybody at any stop ever asked me, you know, what's your dream job? University of Florida, assistant coach. Like, I could have stayed there forever. And, you know, but like most dreams, man, eventually you wake up. And, you know, after year two, we had a really disappointing year. Started the year ranked in the top 15 in the country and then had a major transfer in the middle of the season. And we got fired after year two. And that was the first time in my career, and you guys have heard about all of it so far tonight, that I had really experienced failure. Every single stop seemed like another step in the ladder, and I was climbing and climbing and climbing, and here I was at a proverbial mountaintop that I could have stayed on forever, but it wasn't meant to be. And so, you know, how did this happen, all of that, like, this is an emotional part of my journey, man. Like, at that point, after the Florida thing didn't work out, I really was thinking about hanging it up and not coaching anymore, because, quite frankly, I was heartbroken. And, you know, it took a village of people, and I really believe this, and everybody should have a village around them that they trust and that they can allow people to say tough things to you, right? Like, part of your village is that. I had people tell me, yo, you are not acting like you're, get up right now. You're stupid. Like, you're going to get a job. You're going to do that. This is what you're going to do. You're supposed to coach. You're supposed to do this. Like, you are great at this. Do this, do this, you know? And so ended up at New Mexico because, again, here's another Big Ten flop. thought I was going to the University of Michigan, didn't get that job, basically tell everybody I'm retiring. One of my people in my village is Kevin McGuff, the head coach at Ohio State. He's the best. Like, he's just blunt. He goes, "All right, Bill, here's what you're going to do. Mike Bradbury from the University of New Mexico is going to call you. He's going to offer you the job. You're going to take it. You're going to move out there. You're going to be great for him. He's going to be great for you. And you're going to win a lot of games." And there you go. That's where I was like, "What did you just say to me? New Mexico?" Like, what? literally 5 minutes later, Mike calls me, does it again. He's like, "Hey, Bill, this is Mike Bradbury, head coach of the University of New Mexico. I just talked to Kevin, been talking about you for a little bit. Job pays this. What you think? Coming?" I mean, it was hilarious. The complete opposite of the Sippus experience. I can't even tell you how I was feeling. I was like, "What? Like, okay, this all, I got to talk to my wife about this, like all this kind of stuff." So, how we got there is a bizarre, journey in bouncing back from a major failure. But man, has it been an awesome ride so far out here in the mountains. And I got to tell you, it's like really the thrill of my career coaching in front of all of these people. Like, we have the most unbelievable fan base. We average 5,000 fans a game. Sometimes we get 10. Like, it's wild to me. I feel this, and I got goosebumps telling you this right now. Like, I wish that every single college women's basketball player could experience what our players get to experience. They have an actual fan base. Like, and they don't take it for granted. Like, dude, we lost in the WNIT Elite Eight, and we lost. And it was a home game in front of 10,000 people. And they gave us a standing ovation for what seemed like 30 minutes as we walked off the floor. Like, that doesn't happen. So this has been, I don't know, man. It's like one of those things, like, I'm supposed to be here. I'm supposed to experience this. It is there's a lot of great things, and we can get more in detail about specific New Mexico stuff. But man, oh man, I wish every coach that listens to your pod would get to experience coaching in front of fans like this. And I wish that every women's basketball player actually got to play in front of fans like that.
So it's funny. I have two questions. First, I'm going to just briefly ask, did your wife know what she was signing up for when she said yes?
Oh, hell no. And you're talking about like at the beginning, right? Like, you're talking about the very first thing. Right. No.
Yeah, I'm talking about the very beginning.
No chance. Okay, and here's a side note story. She loves to tell the story too. So we're at a game. We are engaged at this point. Okay, we're not married yet. Engaged. We're back home for Christmas, and we're at a Gator men's basketball game. And I'm sitting, obviously, like, I worked for the men's team a while back, so coaching staff left me tickets, right? Me and Courtney tickets behind a bench, and we're sitting right next to Christine Donovan, Billy Donovan's wife, and Courtney's talking to Christine for whatever, I don't know, a little bit in the game at some point, and I hear Courtney say to Christine, what do you think? Should I do it? Any advice for a future coach's wife is basically what she says. And Christine Donovan says, "Don't do it." I'll never.
Thanks a lot, Mike, Christine.
I'll never forget that. So no, she did not. She's a trooper. She's been at a lot of stops, but the thing is, like, basketball's allowed us to see the world. We've traveled. We've been to Europe. We've been all over the place. She's come on trips with us too. Like, our kids are very cultured, and we're very fortunate that I get paid to do this. Like, that stuff is just hilarious to me. Like, I love what I do. I never work anywhere. This is just like, this is what I do. I don't feel like it's work ever. And yet I still get paid to do it. So we're very grateful.
Yeah, that's very cool. All right. I want to ask you about the fan piece of it, because I think that's interesting. We've talked to a couple coaches that coach on the men's side at Division III level, and several of them had either had experience as players or they had maybe coached in high school. And they talked about how one of the things that sometimes they found to be a challenge was, they're like, we can coach a game. And just like you said, there might be, 35 people in the stands watching our games, the players' parents, and, you know, maybe a random professor or somebody that wandered into the gym accidentally. And I think that, you know, you think about what sometimes, you know, generates and drives excitement in coaches and players, and, you know, obviously the fans and the environment certainly add to that. And so I can especially tell, just, I mean, I can hear the passion in your voice for those fans and the fact that you get to be in that environment. And you've also clearly had an opportunity to coach where that wasn't the case. So if you think about the environment, how did you, and maybe you didn't realize that the environment, you know, what was lacking when you were in an environment that didn't have those fans, but what do you do maybe as a coach to overcome the fact that you're not playing in front of big crowds? Is there anything that you can do? Is that something that you ever talk about as a staff, or you talk about with the players, you know, how can we get more fans in the stands? Or is that something that you just kind of just, you don't even
that's
address?
Really hard. That's a hard question, because where do you want to put your energy to? Right. It's like, and as somebody that aspires obviously to be a head coach very soon, I do think about this a lot. And I think that community engagement and legitimate community engagement, where you are, the team is actually a part of the community and they want to be a part of your team, that drives attendance. And then in turn, that helps drive winning. But there is a threshold where eventually, you know, you got to put your energy into things that will directly affect your winning as well. So we play in front of no fans every time we go on the road, man, in the Mountain West. And to answer your question on that kind of stuff, like, you know, the create your own energy comment that you hear from a lot of coaches, like, I think it's no different. You play in front of fans or you don't. You should be the most enthusiastic team in the country. That's a goal of ours here at New Mexico. Like, we're gonna celebrate like crazy whenever we make a big play, whether we got 8,000 people in the pit going nuts behind us, or if there's 250 people booing the crap out of us in Las Cruces. Like, it's not going to matter, because that's the culture that we want to have. One that we want to have a culture that travels. And so that's huge for us. And it goes back to the people that you allow in, right? So you got to recruit people that, you know, are passionate. You got to recruit people that get excited for others and want to be a part of something great and all that kind of stuff. You know, and I think if you have those people, then they'll connect better with the community as well. And then you can do those things that you're asking. How much do you focus on getting fans in the stands and all that? Well, like, for example, yesterday, you know, our team went and literally, you know, with masks on, went and delivered, you know, signs for people's yards, like we are New Mexico signs for all our season ticket holders. And that's a little thing, but man, oh man, did our fans' faces light up, because they don't know if they're going to get a chance to see our team play in person this year. So that's just some of the ways that we do it. And I don't know, it's something I do believe in engaging in the community, but I do think that it's one of those things where, man, if you have a team that's fun to be around, they're going to want to be a part of that.
Yeah, I think that's good stuff. And I don't think there's any doubt that when you have that type of team camaraderie that, you know, generates excitement, that you're going to attract more fans. You're going to get more people to be involved in it. I wanted to ask you, just kind of as we've gone through this whole journey of your career as an assistant coach, and, you know, at various times we've kind of talked about and hinted at your desire to at some point take over your own program. So I wanted to ask you what it is that you've done over the course of your assistant coaching career when it comes to preparing to be a head coach. And do you have a file folder? Do you have computer files? Do you have a 3-ring binder? How have you gone about kind of taking the things that you've learned along the way and compiling them so that when you do eventually get an opportunity to be a head coach, that you're prepared? Just talk a little bit about your preparation, that of course you're focused on what you're doing in the moment, but you're also looking at, there's the potential to have an opportunity to be a head coach maybe at some point in your career. So how have you gone about preparing for that over the course of your various stops?
That's grown, okay, and changed over the years as I've acquired more knowledge on how to organize my thoughts. I'm a really, everyone that's ever worked with me will be able to tell you if they came on the pod, like, oh my God, what is going on in that guy's mind? Like, he has so many thoughts and they're sometimes brilliant, sometimes ridiculous. Like, but he never writes anything down. Like, especially early in my career, like that used to drive people crazy. Like when we were putting together the attack and the offensive stuff, like I wouldn't have anything written down. Like it was literally all in my head. I don't know. I barely could probably write it down. It was just, I knew it. Okay. Well, that's changed for me. And a lot of people have challenged me in that regard. And like I said, you know, working with really, really good people and that make you realize, oh crap, you're not as good as you think you are. Watching Megan Duffy, apply for head coaching jobs and interview for head coaching jobs helped me tremendously. Because I realized how freaking unprepared I was for that opportunity at that point. And so I got three things for you that I think can help, have helped me. Okay. One, I stole this from Greg Popovich. I literally have a suggestion box on my desk, and you could call it a thought box, suggestion box, whatever it is. Everybody in our program, and I've had this since GW, knows where it is, what it is, and I have a stack of index cards next to it. Sometimes it's a suggestion box for myself. If something comes to my mind that I like for the future, how I would do something, a drill that I like, something, it could be random, all those random thoughts I'm talking about, those little bursts, I will write it down on the index card. I'll put it in the suggestion box for me, and I review that suggestion box at the end of every month. Okay, so I'm coming up on a review of that suggestion box here probably tomorrow, huh? But also anybody can throw suggestions in that box too. So I stole that from Pop, and I love it. And it's like one of my favorite times of the year. It's when I get to review them every month and then review every suggestion over the course of a year. The second thing I became addicted to on my iPhone is the notes function. And I have a running note on my iPhone that literally says head coaching thoughts. And I have organized that note to the 1,000,000th degree. And I have every single aspect of my future program on a note in my phone. How we're going to guard underneath out of bounds, how we're, you know, suggestions on maybe quick hitters for if we do have a low post player, like literally every possible thing as a head coach. How would I handle communication with staff? What are some good examples of staff meetings? It is the coolest note that I ever did. And I started doing that because I watched Diane Richardson at GW take notes in every single meeting she ever was. And they were very detailed notes. So I started just doing it on my phone. And then the third thing is I do have a Google Drive that I manage with all of my information. So I've been fortunate enough to interview for some head jobs already and get to the table and get to on-campus interviews and all that. And when you do that, it forces you to prepare your thoughts and organize your thoughts. So I put those all in Google Drives and organize my thoughts from my notes, from the suggestion box, from interview questions that I didn't see coming. And I put those all in a Google Drive so that I can review that and add to that whenever I need to. So that's how I'm actively preparing for when my time comes and when I do get that opportunity.
Yeah, I can see how that over the course of time that your philosophy and just your preparation would shift, because clearly early in your career, you're not really even thinking about that being a possibility. You're just trying to get your career off the ground and get started. And then as you move forward and you get an opportunity to work for great head coaches and work with quality assistant coaches, you start to think that maybe that becomes a reality. And now you begin to prepare and do the things that you just described in order to help you to get those opportunities. We're coming up. We blew past an hour and a half. So I want to kind of wrap this up by asking you a couple more questions here. And this is kind of a two-parter that I've kind of been using to end the episodes over the past couple weeks. And that is, what's your biggest challenge as you look moving forward? And you could take that as a short-term challenge for, you know, next season at the University of Mexico, or just if you look out further in your career, what's your biggest challenge? And then number two, what's your biggest joy when you wake up in the morning and you're going into the office to get an opportunity to work? And clearly we can sort of eliminate COVID as, you know, take that out of the equation and instead focus on just what it would be in normal circumstances. What's your biggest joy about coaching college basketball?
Sure. My biggest challenge is a constant one, and it's trying to maintain a balance of being a dad, a husband, and a coach all at the same time while trying to be the best ever at each one, right? Like you, and so it's very, very interesting. And with just the way we would handle any challenge with our team or how I address challenges with our players, like you really got to evaluate it and know yourself and, you know, and also like, you know, listen, like I talked about with, the, you know, the difference in conversations I started having with our players at Hofstra, like, man, I gotta listen to my wife more. I gotta listen to my kids when they're asking me to do things with them at certain times, and because next thing you know, they're gonna be older like your kids, man. And I don't want them to have any. I don't want to have any regrets about certain things that I've done or the time that I've spent doing other things than I could have been riding bikes with my daughters or, you know, doing something with my family. So those are. You know, I'm very cognizant of that challenge, and it's constantly every day. I'm making sure that I win that challenge. And on the side, the joy, you know, the question, and my biggest joy from coaching, it comes from the journey of every single season is different. Every team is different. You know, no season is the same. Even if you have a bunch of returners, so like. I just get a unbelievable joy of the journey of a season from beginning to end. And regardless if it's a winning season or losing season, like there's just so many little moments that I love and I love to celebrate. Yeah, the wins are amazing and they're so fun. But dude, so is the travel. And so is like the practice and the prep and the preseason and, you know, and the hilarious jokes during pregame meals. And, you know, I don't know. I just love every bit of it. So the journey is what I get the most joy from in coaching, man.
Very cool. I think that's a great answer. And I think it speaks to just everything that we've been able to talk about tonight. And clearly your passion for the game and for coaching has come through loud and clear from the very first opportunity you have to sit in the film room while you're still in college and just dissect hours and hours of film up until, you know, your current stop at New Mexico and the opportunity that I'm sure you're going to get eventually to be able to take over your own program and become a head coach and take all the things that you've learned from the mentors that you've been fortunate enough to have in the game. I think the journey is really, again, we always talk about appreciating the process and we try to get players to, you know, appreciate the process and fall in love with the process. And that's come across loud and clear from you tonight. Before we get out, Bill, I want to give you a chance to share with people how they can reach out to you, share your social media handles. How can we follow more of University of New Mexico women's basketball, and just give us an idea of where people can get in touch with you if they want to just call you up or talk to you about all things basketball.
This will be easy. Okay. I'm very open with this stuff. So I'll give everybody my cell phone number. You know, it's reach out to me, man. This is how I became better as a coach. I always, back then people didn't have cell phones at first. So you couldn't do this kind of stuff, but I want to call me or text me or whatever. It's my number is 352-317-2636. You know, and I love talking with anybody that wants to be better or has any questions or you heard anything on here that you like, that you want to talk more about with me. You know, Twitter, I'm at Coach Ferrara. It's Coach and then Ferrara. And same thing on Instagram. I'm very active on both platforms. And then, you know, as far as New Mexico is concerned, it's at UNM Lobo WBB is the best way to follow us on Instagram and Twitter. We're going to be a fun team this year for you guys to watch. And I hope that we get to play a full season so you can watch us play deep into March, man.
Absolutely. I think we're all hoping for that. And I guess it still remains to be seen, but I think everybody's crossing their fingers and hoping that once college basketball gets up and rolling, that we can keep it going and everybody stays safe and we're able to play out the entire season. And I know that everybody out there who's a basketball fan is rooting for that, all the way from the youth players who are in second and third grade all the way up through, you know, it looks like the NBA is going to pull it off and the WNBA is going to pull it off. So kudos to those leagues, and hopefully college basketball is going to be able to do the same this season. We're all very, very hopeful of that. Bill, cannot thank you enough for spending an hour and a half, hour and 45 minutes, whatever we ended up doing tonight. It was an absolute pleasure to get a chance to know you, to talk to you, to learn about your journey and all the great things that you've done in your career to this point. And it's going to be a pleasure to watch you move forward in your career, continue to grow and see the things that you're going to do, not just now and not just this season, but on into the future. So thank you for that. We really appreciate it. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
If you have an existing podcast or are looking to launch your own pod but aren't sure where to start, the team at My Podcast Manager can help. Our podcast team works behind the scenes so you can do what you do best. We'll help you launch your podcast, make it sound great, and free up your time for the more enjoyable parts of podcasting. If you're ready to put your podcast editing, production, and promotion on autopilot with a trusted team of podcasting professionals, visit mypodcastmanager.com to get started.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.